Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Cheltimer, my co-host Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and our guest this week, Christopher Black, poet, novelist, and non-fiction writer. You've published a novel, Chris, a political thriller with social overtones, partly based on your experiences as a criminal lawyer, called Beneath the Clouds. What is this book about?
The plot is about a group of lawyers who get involved in a murder trial and find out that it's not just a simple murder, it has a political motivation to the murder involving American influence on Canadian government figures and influential people in the country. And a professor and a newspaper editor try and get that information out to the public. And there's a group of bad people trying to stop them from doing it. So the book is basically a long chase, really, once you get going. It's a long chase scene where they're all trying to get the information out before they're stopped.
Interesting. And now you're working on a second one. Is it also a political thriller?
I've got four I'm working on. One is a sequel to that, where the same set of lawyers are involved with what happens after that, because I stopped the novel at a point where they've succeeded in saving the information and getting it published, but then the powers that be step in and crush them. And the people they helped end up in more trouble. So there's a sequel there, and I'm trying to work on that, but I'm having difficulty completing it. I have another novel I'm working on. The conceit is that people stop going to work. It's called The Day Work Stopped. And I'm fascinated with the idea, but it's proving a lot more complicated than I thought because of the implications. When I started thinking through what happens if people just don't stop showing up for work, what happens to society, then what happens and all the consequences, it's much more complicated than I thought it would be. But it intrigues me, what would happen if people just decide not to go to work one day?
Yep. Well, they use that as a political weapon in various places, don't they?
Yes.
I'm thinking in Zimbabwe lately, that's exactly what happened. Everybody just went and stood in the street, and that was their protest.
Right.
Nobody went to work.
This one's not like a general strike, though, although the government thinks it's a general strike, but it's more of an individual thing which happens to happen coincidentally at the same time across the society. And why that happens is also a problem for me. I haven't figured out quite why that happened. but that intrigues me, what would happen. So I am intrigued by those ideas of taking something, a thought experiment to another place and finding out where it would go.
Yeah. So do you always start with a what if? Like, where do you get your ideas for plots and characters?
Right. The first one, Beneath the Clouds, it was an attempt by me to express some things which happened to me which I could not express otherwise because people didn't believe when I told them what happened to me really in life. I thought I should write it in a fictional form. So the book, the backdrop for that book is what really happened to me in Africa and the trials I was doing and who I met and things that actually happened to me and all the people, the composites of people I knew. The other novel I'm just talking about is something totally out of my head. It's just an idea I have which I'd like to develop, and I hope I can continue it.
And when you write fiction, what has it taught you about yourself?
The same thing as the poetry. It's taught me that there are deeper things in there than I thought. I'm sometimes surprised what I come out with, as I said before. But as I also found that in court, you make an argument and you think you have one argument, you end up spinning something else out to the people listening. So I like playing with ideas, with concepts, and juxtaposing different ideas and seeing what comes of that. And playing with words also is a great pleasure for me. I like writing. I don't write quickly. I'm slow at it, but I like the play of it and the creativity of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the next book I'm going to ask you about, I think the whole thought of it is quite overwhelming for me, but it's a book about an actual trial in which you were involved, I believe, involved for 14 years.
Yes.
At the International Criminal Court in The Hague. So that's pretty high-level stuff. And it also revolves around a letter that you received in 1999. And I can't pronounce the general's name. Perhaps you could say it for us.
Dindili Amana.
Okay, there you go. And he was telling you that he was the chief of staff of the Rwanda
National Police. Yes.
Yeah, the police, from 1992 until what is known in the media as the genocide that took place in 1994. And he asked you to defend him at his upcoming trial. So all sorts of questions come to mind, like, why did you want to take this case? And, you know, can you tell us a little bit about the context and the people how this then became writing as opposed to a job?
Well, I got involved and I had a legal aid practice in Toronto. I was doing mainly jury trials, murder trials, and things like that. And I was fairly successful. But I was also involved in political actions at that time with the different poverty groups in Toronto and so on. Anyway, some lawyers in Montreal suggested I should be defending some of these people at these UN tribunals, and I put my name on the council list. And then this general wrote an article I had written, published in a journal, and liked it about international law, and wrote to me and asked me to be his counsel. And I was reluctant at first because I didn't want to go to Africa. It's tough to do a criminal practice in Toronto. It's tough enough without traveling around, and it was going to cost me money. And I wasn't too keen on going to Africa at that time. In my life, I was getting divorced at that time. All sorts of personal things were going on. But they put a lot of pressure on me, and then I began thinking it might be very interesting to do, and an adventure, and I get to travel around. And a genocide case, I couldn't really top that in my career ever. Mm-hmm. So I decided to take it, and then I got on the council list, and there's a lot of things that happened between that and getting to Africa. But finally, I was on my way to Africa, and I was surprised that my first trip was actually going, but then I arrived. And the novel starts with me, or the new book starts with me going down to Africa to meet this general. Then I've only written one chapter because I don't know how to finish it yet, because is it a book about the trial, what happened in the trial itself, which in each day was very dramatic? Is it about what I learned about what really happened in that war, which is not what you read in the newspapers? Is it about my personal life outside the courtroom in Africa? Is it about me, or is it about the general? And I haven't yet figured that out. Plus, there are things I can't say. I mean, there are things which are confidential I can't reveal. There are people I can't write about because it would get them in danger. So I have to, do I use pseudonyms? How do I write about this trial? And how do I write a 14-year-old trial, make it in 300 or 400 pages, and make it compelling reading without driving people crazy with details? So that's what is difficult for me. But I have one chapter which I like.
Well, it's a start.
The opening is a start. Yeah.
Well, I think it's probably about all those things, and probably. Maybe hinging it on the character who's the lawyer is probably one way to tie it all together.
Yes, I suppose. Yeah. So maybe it's about me and what happened to me.
I think so. I think books very often are, even if they're set in, you know, exotic places or they're doing amazing things. At the root of it all, they're about people.
Right. And I need to get this story out because, it's important about historically what really happened in this trial, because it's a very important event. Canadian government was involved, and this General Dallaire was involved. I met him, and I've talked to him, met him, and cross-examined him, various other people. And this general was a very important man. He was the head of if you think of the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews, he was the head of Gestapo. And yet he was acquitted in this trial. He won the acquittal on all the charges. And one wonders, well, if the head of the Gestapo is acquitted, what does that mean? How could that happen? What really happened then? So people, if they read it, would then begin questioning what really happened. And that's a whole other world.
Yeah, sounds interesting. Do you have an excerpt that you can read to us from that?
Yes, I brought an excerpt which of my first visit to the UN prison, which was based this tribunal was based in Tanzania, because Rwanda's next door. And the prisoners were held in Tanzania, the trials were held there. And this is a description of when I arrived at the UN prison there, my impressions of it when I first arrived, and my first meeting with this general.
Okay.
So I'll read that. I'm going to say the UNDF, that's the UN, the name for the UN prison is UNDF. The UNDF at Arusha is small and half hidden by trees, the local jail and the airport, so it is difficult to see from the main road. At one time, lawyers were allowed to enter the main gate by car, but later we were stopped from using the gate and had to walk through the living areas for the prison guards. These were wooden shacks containing a couple of rooms and a pen for holding cows that were used for milk. Chickens pecked for food on the path through this area, and small children played among the trees. The children always said, "Hello, mister," or "Good day, sir," in very practiced English, and were happy when they were given a reply. Often they would look at you shyly and say, "Shukumu," a sign of respect to an elder, to which one has to answer, "Marahaba." Failure to do either is considered very bad manners. Shikamu in Swahili means "I kiss your feet," and the reply means roughly a thousand thanks. This was the first time. I was way through the main entrance after leaving the taxi I'd come in. I walked down a path through trees and flowers to another gate with a UN sign on it, beyond which was a gravel parking lot where several white UN 4x4s were parked. At the end of this area was a door that led through into an anteroom to the UN prison. Here the guards searched me and asked me to sign in the visitor book. One of them, Monica, a small, chubby Tanzanian lady who was a UN security officer, asked me who I wanted to see and seemed happy when I told her it was General Ndindili Amana, and said what a gentleman he was and how I was lucky to defend such an important man. I found that reaction unusual for a prison officer. She called on a phone and spoke to another officer and asked that an officer come to take me to an interview room. I was escorted through a side door and exited onto an outdoor path that led to the prison compound where the prisoners were held. To the left, a set of stairs led up to another building that housed the administrative offices. I walked through down the path, and a guard showed me into a low room, one of a series on either side of the path, about 10 on either side. They had corrugated roofs, open windows, stucco walls, and one table and several benches inside. The guard asked me politely to sit and left. About 10 minutes later, General Ndindili Amana came in and in French greeted me and we shook hands. He invited me to sit down and looked at me carefully and straight in the eye.
Okay, I'm ready to find out what happens next.
Yes.
Yes, well, I said straight in the eye was important because he was. It turned out that he had been framed up. And the judgment in that case is unique because I said all through the trial that this was the charges were politically motivated and they were all fabricated. It was 60 counts of genocide. Like his men had done bad things there and killed people there and here and there. And every one of those charges turned out to be fabricated.
Wow.
The judges wrote in a paragraph that Mr. Black, all through trial, claimed this was a political trial and the charges were fake. We didn't believe him, but now we're convinced he's telling that he was right. And we agree with him.
Great. So. Well, thank you very much, Chris. And we look forward to the publication of that for sure.
I hope it comes out in the next couple of years. It might take me to.
Well, that's all right. Where can listeners buy a copy of Beneath the Clouds or see samples of your writing?
Right now it's for sale in Campbellford at Kerr's Bookshop, and it's also available on Amazon. I haven't got it for sale elsewhere yet. I'm hoping.
Okay.
I've got a few sales on Facebook, but...
Oh, that's good. Yeah. And listeners, if you'd like to connect with us here at the program, please send your comments, queries, or suggestions for whom we might interview in future programs to our website, wordonthehills.com. At the website, you'll find our previous broadcasts all archived, so you can listen to them at any time. Thanks for tuning in today. We hope you'll join us again for another program next week, Sunday at 1 p.m., right here on Northumberland 89.7, Truly Local Radio.